Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Lassiter against the Department of Social Services. If you heard the rumors that Lee may be the Solicitor General,
I know he's been concerned. His parents long car.
20 years.
Then and he had your old job.
Bill. Civil division. He argued about three cases up here while he was.
Mr. Evans?
Yes, Mr. Justice? Mr. Chief Justice Berger, may it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether appointed counsel is the process that is due indigent parents when the state initiates actions to terminate their parental rights. The state of North Carolina terminated the parental rights of Abigail Lassiter, an indigent, imprisoned mother, without affording her the assistance of appointed counsel. This contested proceeding was initiated and prosecuted by the state through its authorized official, Durham County Department of Social Services, the respondent before this honorable court. The respondent was represented by a staff attorney and by a social worker. In rendering its decision to terminate parental rights, the trial court expressly stated that it relied upon the testimony before the court and the record before the court. The North Carolina Court of Appeals affirmed this decision, holding that the right to family integrity is a constitutionally protected right, that the state has invaded this constitutionally protected right, but that this invasion was not so serious or unreasonable as to compel the court to hold that appointed counsel was a process that was constitutionally due to poor. To the contrary, Mr. Justices, appointed counsel is the process that must be due if indigent parents are to be afforded an adequate opportunity to be heard in termination proceedings. There is a per se need for appointed counsel because of an inherent risk that exists if otherwise.
Has this court ever gone beyond the criminal proceedings in requiring states to appoint counsel in particular proceedings?
No, Mr. Justice, civil proceeding. This court hasn't appointed counsel in a purely civil proceeding. This court has held that in a non-criminal proceeding, such as Gagnon, that the right to appointed counsel may exist.
Or Henry Gault is another one, isn't it?
Pardon?
Gault, the Gault case?
Yes. And
where the state, at least, denominated that a non-criminal proceeding.
Yes, Mr. Justice. And a plurality of the court recognized in Vitek v. Jones the need for appointed counsel.
Has the court required appointed counsel in federal habeas corpus proceedings?
No.
As a constitutional requirement?
I do not know, Mr. Justice.
No. The answer is no.
Okay. All parties involved have a compelling reason to prevent erroneous terminations.
Well, before we leave that, Mr. Evans, is it not inherent in the rationale of the Gault and the other cases that because the juvenile proceeding was so nearly a criminal proceeding that the criminal safeguards in various respects had to be incorporated? Isn't that the rationale?
I think, Mr. Justice, that was the rationale for Gault. However, in Vitek v. Jones, the court was dealing with the transfer of a prisoner to a mental institution involuntarily. There was no question about his right to freedom from bodily restraint being involved there. That right had already been extinguished, and the majority of the court recognized that there was a right to, a plurality of the court recognized there was a need for appointed counsel in those cases to protect the interests involved. Practical considerations will not mitigate against the indigent parents' compelling need to be heard. Specifically, the case at bench is distinguishable from the vast majority of civil cases. Fiscal and administrative burdens involved do not justify the denial of such fundamental rights.
Well, now, I don't quite follow that. You say that the Constitution protects family integrity.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
And while you may or may not be right, there's certainly nothing in the explicit words of the Constitution that do protect that.
No.
But the Constitution explicitly protects a person from being deprived of his property without due process of law. And that's what happens in the run-of-the-mill civil case if the defendant loses. He is deprived of his property, some of his property, if there's a judgment against him for money. And therefore, why doesn't your argument apply in spades to every civil case?
Well, Mr. Justice, this case is distinguishable from the vast majority of civil cases under...
Only in that this one does not involve something explicitly protected by the Constitution.
Well, this court has recognized, Mr. Justice, that the right to integrity of the family unit is a constitutionally protected right, a 14th Amendment due process liberty interest.
Well, now, but and that's by judicial decision of this court, assuming you're correct.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
But the Constitution literally and explicitly protects somebody from losing his property without due process of law.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
So why isn't that an a fortiori case, an ordinary run-of-the-mill civil case?
Yes, Mr. Justice. But this case is distinguishable from that justice on the weight of the liberty interests involved.
You think that something that this court has dreamed up is more weighty than something that's in the Constitution itself?
The right to one's children, the right to keep one's relationship intact with his child, is more fundamental than property interests.
Well, that has to be your argument, I expect, doesn't it?
Yes, Mr. Justice. This court has recognized that the right to integrity of the family unit is far more precious than property rights. This right comes to the court with more respect than those liberties derived from shifting economic arrangements. Lower courts have recognized that the integrity of the parent-child relationship may be more precious than freedom from bodily restraint. Even some lower courts have recognized that the right to integrity of the parent-child relationship is more precious than the right to life itself.
Well, Mr. Evans, the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Do you think this court is free to say that one is more important than the other when the Constitution has equated them?
Yes, Mr. Justice. I think that this court has recognized that liberty interests are more fundamental than property interests.
Didn't Stanley against Illinois say just that?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
That there was a liberty interest in keeping the family together?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
Stanley said that. Don't forget it.
Right, and Stanley said expressly that the liberty interest involved there was far more precious than property rights and was more precious than those liberty interests derived from shifting economic arrangements. The Lower courts have recognized a per se need for appointed counsel. They justify this position on the fact that inherent risk calls erroneous terminations in such cases. These inherent risks are that the pool will be overborne by the resources of the state, and that the final decision terminating parental rights will be based on incompetent and inadmissible evidence. Thirdly, that existing procedural safeguards will be lost. And fourthly, that crucial factual disputes and complex issues will go unresolved. The case at bench is certainly illustrative of each of these inherent risks.
Isn't each of those characteristics present in the civil case that Mr. Justice Stewart was putting to you? Is that not a potential in every civil case?
Not in every civil case, Mr. Justice. The majority of civil cases, you have private party initiating and prosecuting the action. However, in the case at bench, we have the state initiating and prosecuting the action.
What about a state condemnation action where the state initiates an action to condemn so much of your property?
Yes, Mr. Justice, in that situation, you do have the state acting, and we would have to look to other aspects of this case for distinction, distinguishing this case from that case. Now, this case can be distinguished from the vast majority of civil cases under each prong of the Matthew v. Eldridge analysis. Under the first prong, the...
Mr. Evans, let me go back to... prior question. Suppose this case had been instituted by a foster parent, not the state. Would you be here?
In North Carolina, Mr. Justice, I believe so. The initiation of the action by a private party there would be the only difference between that case and this case. In a foster parent case, you would have the state having substantial interest in the outcome of the litigation. You would have the state having a parent's patriotic duty to protect the best interests of the child, to protect the integrity of the family. And indeed, you would have, if there is an answer filed in that case, if the indigent parent files an answer in that case, you would have the state appointing counsel to represent the child. So in essence, you would have the possibility of the very same case here. An attorney for the child could very well be the adversary to the parent rather than an attorney for the state. In reference to in distinguishing this case from the vast majority of civil cases, Under each prong of the Matthew v. Eldridge analysis, we can distinguish this case. The first prong of the Matthew v. Eldridge analysis is the protectable interest implicated by the governmental action. We've already discussed that this case deals with the government initiating and prosecuting an action. In the vast majority of cases, we simply do not have that. This case deals with a basic human right, the right to integrity of the parent-child relationship.
Well, suppose, Mr. Evans, you had a profession that required a state license in order to practice, and a proceeding were brought to revoke the practitioner's license, and he were indigent. Would what your argument today apply in his case also?
Yes, Mr. Justice, I think so.
You think so?
I think that my argument that this case will be distinguished from those cases would apply.
What ground would you distinguish?
The interest that is implicated. In that case,
That certainly would be a license. What would be property interest or liberty interest or one of the other, or both?
I would think that it could be either, but it would be distinguishable from this case on the weight of the interest involved. This case deals with perhaps the most basic right known to man.
Well, here's a man's about to lose his livelihood. He may no longer practice his profession. Isn't that a rather significant interest?
Yes, Mr. Justice, and perhaps in future cases, this court may weigh the factors involved and decide that should be protected.
Then you do concede that if we agree with you in this case, we're not going to be able to contain it. The principle of this kind of case, we're going to have to face up to it in a lot of other types of cases, aren't we?
I would certainly think that the court would have to face up to it, but the court definitely can distinguish this case from those cases. It would not be automatic.
Well, surely your rule would require that the child be represented.
Mr. Justice, certainly I think the child should be represented in these cases. However, I am not sure as to whether this court...
I would think it would be a fortiori.
Pardon?
I would think it would be an a fortiori argument. The child, at least the parent is an adult and supposedly capable of representing himself. I suppose guardian ad litem are really appointed because the child is a minor. Is that right?
Yes, Mr.
But
Justice.
Your argument, I would think, would require the appointment of counsel for the child.
The reason that appointment of counsel was granted, need to be granted in these cases, is that there's a constitutionally protected liberty interest that has been recognized by the court that needs to be protected. Now, I recognize the very important...
That is a two-way street, the integrity of the parent-child relationship.
Yes, but this court has not recognized as of yet, Mr. Justice, that the child has a constitutionally protected right in the integrity of the family. And that is a point of distinction.
Mr. Evans, hasn't the state of North Carolina already recognized that and passed the statute giving counsel at juvenile hearings?
Yes, Mr. Justice. The state of North Carolina does grant...
Well, certainly if there was a relinquishment proceeding where the parent was going to relinquish the child to the state, I would suppose your argument would be that the child would have to be represented.
Well, isn't that exactly what the statute says on page 20? The new statute, what is this statute in the joint appendix? The joint appendix at page 20.
Okay. The new statute, the joint appendix on page 20 or the brief?
The joint appendix.
Okay. That statute says, Mr. Justice, that in abuse, neglect, and dependency cases, the right to appointed counsel will be granted to indigent parents.
So they do recognize that when you're taking children from the parents, in some instances you're entitled to counsel.
Yes, Mr. Justice, it does.
Well, what effect does that have on this case?
Well, Mr. Justice, I think it shows that the basic inconsistency, the recognizing of the right to appointed counsel for parents, indigent parents, in abuse, neglect, and dependency cases in which the parental rights is faced with a temporary removal, but not recognizing the same right in a case in which the parental rights is faced with a total severance, certainly is inconsistent.
Are you making an equal protection argument there? This is the choice of the legislature to provide counsel in that situation. Now, are you suggesting it's a denial of equal protection not to supply it here?
Mr. Justice, I think that there may even be an equal protection argument, but we need not reach that today. The argument that we have made today is that the due process clause requires appointment of counsel in these cases.
What's the reach of this statute, Mr. Evans? What is a juvenile petition? What's that refer to? Particular kind of proceeding or something?
Yes, an action that's filed in a juvenile court.
Which is not this case.
Yes, I think...
Was this case brought by something called juvenile petition?
Yes, the action was filed by a juvenile petition.
Why doesn't this statute apply then?
Well, this statute was passed after the case.
Well, I know,
this case in hand.
Why shouldn't we send it back and ask your state courts to look at the case in light of that statute?
Right, and it applies only in abuse, neglect, and dependency cases.
Right.
And this is a termination case. And
I see.
It does not apply.
So this is limited, then?
Yes, Mr. Justice.
No termination.
With respect to that statute, Mr. Evans, it reads, in cases where the juvenile petition alleges that a juvenile is abused, neglected, or dependent, the parent has a right to counsel and to appointed counsel in cases of indigency unless the parent waives the right. Does that suggest that even a parent who could retain counsel if he were not indigent or she were not indigent did not, before the enactment of that statute, have the right to appear by counsel?
I wish we could send
I'm sorry, Mr. Justice.
I mean, at these proceedings before the enactment of the statute, was anybody permitted to appear, to have an attorney?
Yes, Mr. Justice. The right to retain counsel was granted at those proceedings, are granted at those proceedings. All parties involved have a compelling reason to prevent the erroneous deprivations of parental rights. The parent has a compelling interest of preventing the denial of her right to care, custody, and companionship to her child. She has the compelling interest of maintaining the right to transfer cultural, religious, and political values to the next generation. The child loses his right to receive care, custody, and companionship and love from his mother, from his brothers and sisters, and from his grandparents. The child also loses the right to receive its cultural, religious, and political heritage, or the cultural, religious, and political heritage of its people.
Mr. Evans, you're arguing the right of the child right now. Was there a guardian ad litem in this case, or was not, was there?
No, Mr. Justice.
I take it, would that also be constitutional error in your view?
I think a guardian ad litem should be appointed, Mr. Justice, but I'm
not
sure.
Do you think the Constitution requires? In other words, is it a necessary consequence of agreeing with you that we should appoint two lawyers in every parental termination case?
No, Mr. Justice.
Well, why not? Because why isn't the child's interest, which you're just arguing now, also entitled to constitutional protection, and be sure that there aren't arguments with regard to the child's interest that are possibly conflicting with the parents that might be overlooked in the proceeding?
I think, Mr. Justice, that the right should certainly be protected, but first the court would have to recognize that the child right to integrity of the family unit is a constitutionally protected right. And as of this point, the court hasn't recognized that. Society, the state has a substantial interest in preventing erroneous deprivations also. The state has the parent's patriotic duty to protect the best interests of the child. The best interests of children simply are not protected by allowing erroneous deprivations of parental rights. The state has a substantial interest in protecting the family unit. The family unit is responsible for transferring sacred societal values, such as morals, cultural beliefs, and political values. The state cannot transfer these values. And once a child is placed into foster care, then the state is confronted with the problem of how do we prepare this child for these future obligations, such as these sacred values that are needed for a well-rounded child in our society.
Mr. Evans, when will this woman, the mother, be eligible for parole?
Next year, Mr. Justice.
Next year. I was wondering, you're talking about the family unit. There is no family unit now.
Mr. Justice, there is the grandmother in this case who appeared at the termination of parental rights hearing, stated that she was willing to take this child and take care of the child. She is presently taking care of the petitioner's other four children, and certainly if the state had placed this child with the grandmother, then this child's parent-child relationship could have remained intact. This child's
all in the record.
But that is in the trial transcript that has been lodged.
But it is in the transcript and it's lodged in.
That is lodged.
Thank you.
So who is it that should have the appointed counsel, the grandmother or the mother?
The mother, Mr. Justice. The state alleged that the mother did not make a constructive plan for the future of her child. This indigent imprisoned mother made perhaps the only plan. She asked that her child be placed with a member of the extended family. An indigent imprisoned person cannot make any other plans and must look to the family, its family, to help her. And this plan would have been the most constructive plan for everybody involved. It would have kept the parent-child relationship intact. This lady is getting out in a year. She can come home to her family.
Well, now you're addressing the proposition that the decision of the court was wrong. They made a bad and unwise decision.
Yes.
But that's not before us, is it?
Well, Mr. Justice, that aspect of the case is before the court from the perspective that the parent in this case lost certain procedural due process rights. She lost her right to be able to present favorable evidence. She had favorable defenses to present in this case.
And the inference is that had she been represented by counsel, those rights would have been preserved and not lost.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
And the decision would have been right and not wrong.
Yes, Mr. Justice. And there are three basic defenses that she had that were meritorious that certainly counsel could have presented for her.
Did they allow her to, was she paroled from prison in order to appear in the hearing?
She was brought to the hearing, Mr. Justice. Yet she was unable to cross-examine the social worker that testified against her. The trial transcript indicates that she continually tried to testify while she was supposed to be cross-examining. The juvenile court continually admonished her to stop doing so. And finally she gave up her efforts to cross-examine. In the process, she also gave up her right to contest the veracity of this proceedings. Mr. Justice, I see that I have 5 minutes. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Evans. Mr. Odom.
Mr. Chief Justice Berger, may it please the court. At the outset, I would like to point out to you that under North Carolina law, there are two different proceedings by which the Department of Social Services makes an effort to address family problems. The statutory scheme provides that the Department of Social Services must investigate and, to the extent necessary, intervene in those cases where parents can no longer be presumed to be giving proper care and supervision to their children. Those cases I will denominate custody cases, which in addressing the statute that was called into question a few minutes ago, I will also call abuse, neglect, and dependency proceedings. It is this proceeding which represents the initial intrusion into the family unit, into what Mr. Evans would call the family integrity. The child is still with the parents. The parents are presumed, as they are entitled to, be providing proper care and supervision. It comes to the attention of the Department of Social Services that they are not, and the department brings this action to court. Because it is the initial and most, I would argue, significant intrusion into the family unit, the legislature of North Carolina has provided that both the parent and the child be provided with an attorney if they cannot afford one. That is the purpose of the statute, Mr. Justice Marshall, that you asked about earlier. Now, there is a different statutory scheme in North Carolina for the termination of parental rights. That is a totally separate proceeding from the abuse, neglect, dependency, custody proceeding.
And this statute quite definitely does not apply to that proceeding.
That is correct, Mr. Justice Brennan. At the initial custody hearing, if the court determines that the child is to be removed and placed in the custody of the Department of Social Services, which is what happened in this case in May of 1975, the department's interest tends to shift very subtly from that of parens patriae to in loco parentis. The court has given the Department of Social Services certain responsibilities in providing for the interest of this individual child. There are provisions in the law that are being refined constantly by which the court can direct both the parents and the Department of Social Services to work together to try to reunify this family, to put the child back into the home. There are provisions in the law now that require that the custody decision that removed the child be reviewed every 6 months to make sure that the court's mandate is being followed. Now, that did not happen in this case. That statutory provision has been enacted subsequent to this. But what happened in this case was that the family had, once the child was removed from the home, the family abandoned this child in foster care. The mother testified that she had seen him once or twice. She had, in fact, visited with him once at the request of the social worker, but she had not seen him any other time. And there was a period of more than a year from the time that the child was, in fact, removed from her custody until she went into prison, during which time, you could presume that she had the freedom to make some contest or some question.
This was testimony at the hearing?
Yes, sir.
Without a lawyer?
Yes, sir. This record was before, the initial custody proceeding was tried before this very judge who looked back through the file and made a determination that...
Did he have a right to do that?
Yes, sir. The juvenile file...
Was anybody there to contest whether he had that right?
He has the right under North Carolina law.
What I mean, what would the... Could the lawyer contest that?
He could have contested it, but it would have been a fruitless contest under North Carolina law.
Well, then it's your point. It wouldn't do him any good to have had a lawyer anyhow. I hope you're not arguing that.
Well, I'm not going to stand here and argue that the ineffectiveness of lawyers, but I'm saying that the statutory scheme on balance would make their effectiveness in this kind of proceeding minimal as compared to the state's interest in not requiring by statute that they be appointed.
Well, yes. Mr. Shaver, do I understand that presently, under your present law, there could not be a termination proceeding until there had first been a custody proceeding at which the custody was turned over to a state agency?
The Department of Social Services cannot initiate...
Well, I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Until they have, in fact, been given custody by a court.
But now, under your present regime, under this new statute, the mother would have had counsel at the custody proceeding.
That is correct. Yes, sir.
And so... At least she'd have had counsel there.
Yes.
And she might have prevailed against the award of custody to the state agency, which would have meant there would never be a termination proceeding.
That is correct.
At least one initiated by the state agency. Is that right?
That is correct.
Well, then there is some connection between this new statute and this case, isn't there?
Many judges tend to, if in fact this case arose after the effective date of that statute in January of 1980, the court will continue the appointment of counsel so that if, in fact, the child is removed at a hearing at which the parent was represented, that the parent will have the benefit of continued appointment.
Later in the termination proceeding.
If, in fact, it comes up in a termination.
Well, and I do suggest there's some relevance to this new statute to this case.
There, it can be construed in that fashion subsequent to the effective date. But, of course, this all started before then.
But wouldn't the child have a right to counsel, too?
Well, yes. Mr. Justice Rehnquist, what happens?
Under the new statute, that's correct, in a custody proceeding.
He did under the old statute. Uh-huh. And I'll explain why. The department, as I pointed out, it takes on the role of in loco parentis,
right.
the parent role to the child, and is therefore presumed to be acting in the best interest of the child. In the majority of these cases, in the index to our brief, we tried to point out some statistics that we were able to find, that in the majority of these cases, the department has long since exhausted all other alternatives for reuniting the family. And that by the time they bring this action, that is a hopeless cause. In only two cases out of 768 did the court find in a termination action that there were no grounds for termination.
But in this case, there was testimony that the grandmother wanted the child.
But there was conflicting testimony, Mr. Justice Marshall, to the effect that the grandmother had in fact told the caseworker in discussions about that she couldn't take care of the child. There was a flat-out contradiction.
The only thing, as I understand it, is North Carolina says you need two counsel, one for the child and one for the parent, in a temporary procedure.
Custody procedure.
But you don't need any for a permanent procedure.
That is correct. But the distinction is...
What else do I need to rule against you than that?
I think if you could understand what actually happened in practice, you could see why the interest of the state in not doing it is substantial enough to not require it, especially as a matter of constitutional law. What generally happens as a result of the child being removed is that not only as a matter of state law.
Well, what can I do generally? I don't have the slightest idea what generally happens in North Carolina. But I do have a record of this case.
Well, also in this record, Mr. Justice Marshall, is the uncontroverted fact that the woman made no effort to see the child after he was removed. And
it's also in this record, uncontroverted, that she didn't have counsel.
That's right.
Who could have told her that?
When a parent's child, when this woman's child was removed from her, had she... She didn't even appear at the custody hearing, which took the child away from her. That's uncontroverted. She was given two different notices of that hearing.
What do you mean, uncontroverted?
It's uncontested.
Well, how can she contest without a lawyer?
The point I'm making is that it is understood by everyone that she was given notice of the original hearing.
Well, it's not to me unless you show it to me in the record.
All right. It's in the trial transcript, the fact that she did not appear and was given notice of the...
On page 16 of that same record, appendix, narrative of testimony, quote, although a respondent stated to the court that she had informed officials of the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women, officials at that institution, those affected took no action to help respondent receive the assistance of legal counsel.
I'm not
Is
sure.
Is that correct?
I'm not sure. North
Is
Carolina.
Is that correct?
That's what it says. Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's your signature.
I took it that your comment was directed at the earlier hearing.
Yes, sir. That was
not at the hearing that's
in question.
The transcript.
Well, then you say at the first hearing she waived this future hearing?
She waived her right to appear at that hearing and contest the removal of the child from her, Mr. Justice Marshall.
Well, it says here she asked for help.
In this proceeding. She didn't ask for help in this proceeding. What she said was, Judge, I've been talking with this lawyer about post-conviction proceedings for 4 months. Give me some time to go talk to him.
Did you read what I said? She asked the correctional center.
But she didn't ask the court
to
provide.
Well, she wasn't anyplace else but in jail.
She was brought to the hearing. She was brought to the hearing.
just doesn't say it here.
Yes, it does. If you read on down.
Well, where does it say she was brought to the hearing on that paragraph? I'm talking about the bottom of the first paragraph, which you agreed is a narrative of the testimony.
Well, it says that she stated to the court, and she had to be present to the court to state it. She was, in fact, brought to the hearing. But she didn't ask. She did not ask for an appointed counsel.
Well,
she
this woman was in jail.
She was, but she was brought to the hearing.
Well, was she in custody?
When she was brought to the hearing, yes, sir.
Was she ever out of custody?
She has not been out of custody
well,
since
how
July
could she
76?
Get a lawyer while she's in custody?
She had a lawyer.
She for had, her criminal thing.
But she never bothered to mention it to him. If her right to this child was so fundamental, more precious than the right to life itself, it's inconceivable that she wouldn't have said, they're
is
trying to take my child.
Is this a lawyer of her own choice or an appointed lawyer?
It's retained counsel, Your Honor.
Yes. And he was retained for a criminal conviction. Does this lawyer do civil practice?
Yes, sir.
Well, where do I find that?
It's inconceivable that she could not have at least mentioned the proceeding to him.
To me, it's unimportant whether he mentioned it to ABAB. The point was she mentioned it to the authorities, and she couldn't do anything without the permission of those authorities in that prison. She couldn't do anything without their permission.
She could write.
Right?
She could write. She knew
well,
how
could
to
she get a lawyer by writing?
She obtained one through her mother, who...
Well, where is he in this case? He was hired for one deal, not for two.
But she was communicating with him, and the big issue was that she had... And the point to be made from this is that if she, in fact, was so concerned...
Did you have to hear and ask her why she didn't say it?
No, sir, I never did.
That's right. So I don't know, because you didn't give me the information.
But she did say that she had never mentioned this proceeding to him, but had been communicating with him throughout.
She needed counsel. Don't you agree she needed counsel?
No, sir, I don't think so.
Who was protecting her?
You think the state, in respect to this very question, you think the state could have prevented her from having counsel?
No, sir. No, and we will not purport to even argue that.
Well, I know, but suppose the state did. Would it be unconstitutional to keep her retained counsel out of the hearing?
Yes, I would.
Why?
She doesn't
need counsel.
I'm not arguing that counsel would not have been effective in perhaps presenting testimony to the court. I am saying that under the facts of the case, the decision that was made in the trial court was correct.
Well, following up your answer to Mr. Justice White's question, why couldn't the state say that neither retained nor appointed counsel shall represent anybody in these proceedings? It's too destructive of the family relationship to have every incident magnified and made into an adversarial situation. So that we're simply going to conduct these hearings without any lawyers because we think lawyers louse up families.
It's possible, I suppose, that the legislature could do that, but I think it would fly in the face of an inherent presumption that in any kind of legal action that was in fact brought in a court of law, a person is entitled to appear by retained counsel.
Now, that's a presumption fostered by the legal profession, but that doesn't make it constitutional.
Well, I think it would be one that would be given a great deal of attention.
Well, it certainly would because most lawyers or most judges are lawyers.
What would happen, I think, the legislature could do in North Carolina, it could create an administrative body to make a determination as to whether or not the department could make a decision as to whether the woman's rights to the child would be totally and permanently severed. But they chose not to do that. They chose to make it, in fact, a judicial proceeding to take out of the hands of the Department of Social Services the right to make that determination. And they did that because of the recognition of the legislature of the importance of the family right.
Mr. Odom, first let me apologize for having miscalled your name earlier. I just want to be clear. I think you told me earlier, did you not, that under the present regime, the custody aspect, because the counsel by statute now must be provided.
Yes, sir.
If that results in the transfer of custody to a state agency, which then initiates a proceeding to terminate the parental relationship, then counsel, as a matter of practice, even though the statute doesn't require, is provided at the termination hearing also?
I think, as a practical matter, the court tends to extend the appointment of counsel.
Well, tends to. Does the court? Is the practice, in fact, to do it?
My experience has been that some judges do and some judges don't. There is some discrepancy from judicial district to judicial district.
Thank you.
Mr. Odom, when a lawyer is appointed pursuant to the new statute and for an indigent, which is the statute requires, is that lawyer paid by the state?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It is.
Mr. Odom, let me follow through on one factual thing that disturbs me. Does the record disclose whether between the removal in 1975 and the termination in 1978, a department social worker ever contacted the petitioner or her mother?
Yes, it does.
And what does it show?
It showed that she contacted the mother and discussed with her the idea of perhaps giving the child up for adoption or terminating rights or asking her what she wanted to do with the child. And all she said was, I want the child to live with my mother. The social worker then contacted the mother, and at least the transcript, this particular record does not, but Mr. Evans had the transcript lodged with the court, shows that the worker said she contacted the grandmother on several occasions and was told by the grandmother, I can't take care of the child.
On several occasions?
That's what the transcript shows, yes, sir.
On these two times you said that she saw, only two times in the past year she saw a son. Was that the time she was in jail?
No, sir. That was prior to her going to jail.
Well, I'm reading the transcript. I have great difficulty with it. No, you go ahead. I'm going to finish reading this transcript.
I thought you had asked me a question.
Yeah, that's the question I asked you. She was in jail the year before.
Immediately preceding. But the first year after the child was removed from her custody, she was not in jail. In fact, for some 13 or 14 months after he was removed and placed in a foster home, she was not in jail. She was out on the street.
But the last year, she was in jail.
Yes,
sir.
That's
the time you said she didn't see him for the first year. For the last year, she only saw him twice.
What the transcript shows is she hadn't seen him at all since he had been removed but two or three times. Those occurring when, in fact, she was out on the street.
Well, I'll take a look at it. I give you the benefit of the doubt.
All right. In fact, though, the petition was brought on two grounds, and the court concluded, as a matter of law, that she had failed to maintain concern or responsibility as to the child's welfare. And I would submit to the court that the fact that a parent is in prison does not prevent them from maintaining concern or responsibility as to the child's welfare. And she had made no effort to do that. Now, I wouldn't argue that it would have prevented a finding that she had willfully abandoned him, and that was not alleged in this case. I think, in trying to sum up, the obverse of the problem that we're struggling with is if this court requires the appointment of counsel in a civil action as a matter of constitutional law, the court will be hard-pressed to limit it and will be placed in the position from here on of making a determination as to what right is most fundamental enough to require it and those that are not fundamental enough to require it.
Mr. Odom, you personally, as what, assistant county attorney?
Yes, sir.
Was assigned to this case, you were there from the beginning to the end?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shaver.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Perhaps I might begin, Justice Rehnquist, by following up on your question about whether or not the state could dispense with counsel altogether in these hearings. And frankly, sir, I think not, notwithstanding Parham versus J.R. And the reason I think not is that the degree of importance that's attached to the family relationship in Stanley versus Illinois and the other child custody cases is such that the court would not be able to hold that counsel could be barred from the hearings. Justice Brennan, you asked if counsel that are appointed in neglect cases carry over. Ms. Rodham says that in practice they sometimes do. It is not the position of the state that they necessarily are entitled to carry over, although that is the practice of many state district court judges. The question simply has not been addressed in North Carolina law.
Has it any effort to have the legislature address it? I just wonder why the distinction between the custody and the termination proceeding.
Your Honor, I can suggest a couple of possible distinctions. I should say more than possible. I think they are the distinctions. First is this, that the intrusion at the time of the neglect hearing is really the more important intrusion because that's what separates the child from the parent and disrupts the care and the companionship of the child. That's what really sunders the family. And from that point on, what the parent has is not an interest in the companionship of the child, but the expectation that with the help of the state, the child may come back sometime in the future. That interest is a much lower interest. The second point is this, that the County Department of Social Services being charged with this obligation to try and restore the family and having this obligation not only from the time of the neglect hearing on, but prior to the neglect hearing, finds itself in sort of a conflict of interest situation. It's supposed to protect the child on one hand, and on the other hand, it's supposed to try and put the family back together. And one way to keep the County Department of Social Services out of trouble, given this inherent conflict and this responsibilities, is to appoint an attorney for the child and an attorney for the parent, and that's what the state does. The third point, I think, is that very often, although not always, the neglect...
Can I just interrupt? Why isn't the same conflict present at the termination hearing?
By the time the termination hearing comes along, Justice Stevens, the County Department of Social Services has made the decision that the child cannot go home and should not go home. It no longer has an obligation to try and restore that family. It is exclusively concerned with trying to protect the best interests of the child throughout the rest of its life. And so it's not divided. It no longer has...
It's kind of ironic because at the first hearing, it has a greater interest in the parent's side of the potential controversy, and yet the parent has an independent right to counsel. At the second hearing, nobody speaks for the parent except the parent who presumably sometimes cannot do so effectively.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. I can see the irony in that, and I would nevertheless suggest that that the reason is that by the time you get to the termination action, the state's interest is really not readily distinguishable from the interest of any other private person who under the termination statute might also have had standing to bring a termination of parental rights action. Once the state, it's settled that in civil cases generally, the state stands as a private litigant and may bring its resources to bear against its opponent. And when you eliminate that conflict of interest...
There are very few civil situations in which a state sues indigent litigants.
Your Honor, proportionately, yes. But in fact, I think it's not uncommon. Condemnation cases would be a pretty good example.
By hypothesis, somebody who owns a lot of real estate normally is not indigent.
Your Honor, I do a lot of food stamp law and AFDC law, and I find a lot of people with a small parcel of property who have nothing else, and that their prospect would be mortgage the property. And perhaps they couldn't do that because of flaws in the title and so on, or don't eat. So I think that there are indigent persons who nonetheless would be subject to a property condemnation hearing.
Well, I take it anyway, Mr. Schaefer, you're... Legislature has never expressly addressed the question, why not also counsel at the termination hearing?
Your Honor, Mr. Odom includes in the appendix to his brief two bills which did go before the General Assembly but which did not pass. I ought to tell the Court at this juncture that I have also drafted a bill which I understand will be submitted at this session
It was drafted at the behest of certain members of the General Assembly. Whether or not it will pass, I do not know.
Is it also true that there are a great many more custody hearings than there are termination hearings?
Very many more.
So the
Very
legislature might have been more aware of the problem there.
Yes, sir. Yeah. That is a possibility, but I don't know that it's
And
a fact.
Typically, as in this case, a termination proceeding takes place only after there has been a loss of the parent
Yes,
custody,
sir.
By the parent of custody.
Yes, sir.
Although it's not necessarily so in all situations.
Your Honor, I think that in all instances where the government,
yes.
where the county, it is
then
necessarily,
it is necessarily so.
Because the County Department of Social Services first
that,
has
that
to get custody.
That was an answer to my brother
yes.
Brennan earlier.
Yes.
But there are some situations in which there can be a termination hearing without an antecedent custody proceeding.
Not when they're brought
not,
by
not
the county.
When not when they're brought
no,
by
yes,
the
Yes,
so
when they're brought by private parties.
Yes.
I'm sorry. That's correct.
But they're very rare.
I would think that they're on the order of 50 or 60 a year. Typically, they involve step-parent adoptions.
Right.
If I might, let me speak very briefly to the prospect that this decision might be held to be retroactive. The state recognizes that it is asking this court to do something which it's only done once before, and that was in Morrissey versus Brewer. We are saying that if the petitioner prevails on this case, we would like language in the opinion, such as is in Morrissey, to the effect that it is wholly prospective. Justice Stevens saw fit to speak to the question of retroactive or prospective application in Caban versus Mohammed. Justice Frankfurter did the same in his separate opinion in Griffin versus Illinois. We think that this is really a unique case. There are children in North Carolina who have been adopted, whose families are settled. They ought not run the risk that this decision, if against us, is retroactive. Likewise, there are children in North Carolina whose parental rights have been terminated.
We'll
they
resume,
ought not risk that.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, and you'll have about 3 minutes left.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, if I may follow up on a question that Justice Brennan posed before lunch, the question about whether or not you can draw lines between categories of cases. Justice Brennan asked, what would happen if perhaps a termination of parental rights action were brought by a private party instead of by County Department of Social Services, and in fact that case exists. It's being held in abeyance in the Eastern District of North Carolina pending the result in this decision. But there is a husband who is asserting that he has a right to an appointed attorney in a termination of parental rights action, which was prosecuted by his wife without any other government involvement in that.
His wife married somebody else?
Yes, sir.
His former wife?
Yes, sir. His former wife. Similarly, there's a case pending in North
Did
Carolina.
Did he explain to anyone how if he can't afford to... A lawyer? He's going to support his child?
No, sir, he doesn't. It's more ironic than that, Justice Berger, because the man prevailed in the termination action. This is a 1983 action on behalf of a winner, saying that notwithstanding the fact that I won, I should have had an attorney at the earlier case. It's an interesting little case. We've got a case in North Carolina where the question is whether there should be appointed counsel on behalf of a respondent in a child support action, which is prosecuted by the county. And you know that in light of Body versus Connecticut, there have been two state Supreme Court cases where the question is whether or not a respondent in a domestic action has got a right to court-appointed attorney. Now, this line between cases involving personal liberty, you know, your physical freedom, and all the other kind of civil cases and is under assault all over the country. I would suggest that the court needs to consider that very carefully, and that if they do, they're going to remember that the history of the right to counsel in criminal cases is one which shows that distinctions based on degree, distinctions based on the seriousness of the offense, are not distinctions which are going to be able to hold over time. We've moved from Powell to Argersinger and Scott. What happens is
the American Bar Association is taking the position it does in this litigation because it's looking to the long-run best interest of employment for lawyers?
Justice Stevens, I think not. I think the Bar Association, in throughout its entire history, has emphasized the importance of counsel and is strongly committed to providing lawyers for everybody. Look at their position on law school enrollments and compare it perhaps to the position of the American Medical Association in a similar situation.
I suppose this might have an impact on the small claims courts in the states where they preclude any lawyers along the lines of Mr. Justice Rehnquist's suggestion.
I suggested to Justice Rehnquist that the counsel would have to be provided in those instances, perhaps not in your hypothetical, simply because this right to family integrity has been given special treatment by this court and Stanley in the following cases. Thank you very much.
You have about 3 minutes remaining, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. There are several points I'd like to address that the court raised. The first is drawing the line. This case is certainly distinguishable from the majority of civil cases. This case is formal and complex, adversarial, not informal. The full panoply of evidentiary rules apply. The full panoply of procedural safeguards apply. A formal finding of fact and conclusions must be made. It's judicial, not administrative, governmentally initiated, prosecuted, and financed. records that are used and the testimony that are used in these cases often involve testimony by a paid state agent and records that have been compiled by a paid state agent. Likewise, you can look to each of the prongs of Matthews to find points of distinction. Under the first point, state-initiated, state-prosecuted, the fundamentalness of the interest. Under the governmental interest involved, we have the government moving as a party. We have the government having a substantial parens patriae interest. We just don't have that in other cases. Under the third prong of Matthew v. Eldridge, we have the government overbearing the indigent parent by its resources and advocacy skills. In the vast majority of civil cases, we simply just do not have that.
And yet, it's not your contention that this is a criminal prosecution, is it?
No, Mr. Justice.
And that's the line that the Constitution draws, the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution.
The Sixth
Amendment guarantees counsel only in all criminal prosecutions.
The Sixth Amendment does, Mr. Stewart. As far as the question as to what efforts this parent and extended family made towards obtaining this child after the child went into foster care, at the very outset, the grandmother asked the Department of Social Services to place the child with her. The mother wanted the child to be placed with her. You can find reference to that this request in the trial transcript at page 52.
Is there some reference to the notion that she was not able to take care?
Yes, Mr. Justice. There was an allegation by the social worker that she said that she could not take care of the child, that members of her church said that she could not take care of the child. However, at the trial, the grandmother testified that she never made such statements, and indeed that she never would make such statements, because these five children involved are her only grandchildren. She has four children. Petitioner is the only child that has children. And she said that this is my only family, and there's no way that I would give up that right. Likewise, in reference to Mr. Justice Blackmun's question about diligent efforts, the Department of Social Services did not make a diligent effort in this case to try to strengthen the parent-child relationship. The department made only one visit to this parent during the 2 years in issue. One visit. This visit was made 3 months prior to filing a termination of parental rights petition. And the visit was made for the express purpose to ask the parent to give up her parent-child relationship. 2 years, one visit, asking the parent to give up parent-child relationship certainly cannot be classified as a diligent effort to strengthen the parent-child relationship. In reference to Mr. Justice Brennan's questions about abuse and neglect, are grounds for termination of parental rights in North Carolina, so that you do not have to have a prior adjudication in which the child is actually put into the custody of DSS, of Department of Social Services, and then a subsequent termination action. Under certain situations...
Your time has expired now, yes. Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...